This show was first broadcast on Free FM, Hamilton, New Zealand's community access media organisation. For more information on our lineup of shows and the role we play in the media, visit freefm.org.nz.
Welcome to The Science Bug. I'm Morgan Marion.
And I'm Simon Connolly.
In this episode, Simon is chatting with Renee Devenish, who has just finished an awesome piece of research on how pollinating insects, that's insects that spread pollen between flowers, are impacted by changing temperatures and climate change.
I am Renee Devenish. I recently completed my master's. It was ecology master's, and I focused on pollination, specifically insect pollinators and climate change.
Why don't you take me through, in very basic terms, what is pollination?
Well, pollination is what we would call an ecosystem service. So it's basically something, some process that happens in nature that provides a service for humans. It's a human-focused term. And specifically what it is, it's a mutualism or a relationship between plants and an animal, or specifically, and it's a relationship that benefits both of them. And in this case, it benefits them by animals transferring pollen between flowers, so helping flowers with their reproduction. And then in return for transferring the pollen between flowers, the animals get food. So that's, in simple terms, pollination.
And it's the method by which flowers and plants reproduce, right?
Yeah. I mean, there are two methods, really. You get asexual and sexual reproduction. So this is sexual reproduction, pollen being the male gametes is the word for it. So animals help transfer the male genes from the female part of the flower. Yeah.
Brilliant. And you were talking about how pollination is affected by climate change. What are the specific ways in that happened? What have people looked into before?
Right. So it's simplified by giving a couple examples, but it's firstly, I should say that climate change doesn't affect pollination simply. It's not just there are certain ways it happens. It depends on the organisms, and it will depend on the insects it's affecting. It will depend on the plant species, for example. But one way is geographic shifts. So as climate changes, the area that is suitable for a species changes. So it might become too dry for a plant species or too hot for an insect species. So what will happen is they will shift the areas where they live. But perhaps one of them, maybe the bee, won't shift its area with climate change. So what happens is they'll no longer cover the same areas, or they'll cover smaller areas. So less pollination will occur. Another one is what we call temporal or phenological mismatches. And this is when basically the time in which, during the seasons in which either the flowers open or the pollinators, insects emerge, no longer overlap. So they will, for example, in high temperatures, plants flower earlier. There's no bugs around to pollinate them, for example. Or maybe the bugs emerge earlier for some reason and there's no flowers around. They'll miss out on food. And what these things can cause, for example, any kind of mismatch, is it can either just reduce numbers, so abundance in either the flower or the insect, or it can even lead to extinctions. And it has led a couple of extinctions in both plant species and animal species, especially in what we call, specific relationships? Where it's only one insect species and one plant species where pollination occurs between.
Mm-hmm.
So they're a specific pollinator.
So it's a single species of insects, in this case, that relies on a single species of plant or flower.
To get its food. And if that's no longer around, where does it get its food from?
Mm-hmm.
Nowhere. It's going to die out. Especially specialist relationships, insects, or these changes can be really detrimental.
Yeah.
And another interesting one is that actually temperature can change flower shape or size.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So sometimes they might get smaller or bigger in temperatures.
Mm-hmm.
And interestingly, insect pollinators often have preferences.
Mm.
So I know bumblebees, I think it's, remembering the direction, but I think they prefer larger flowers.
Mm-hmm.
So if the flowers they normally pollinate get small over time, they might, because bumblebees are generalist pollinators, so they pollinate a wide variety. You'll see them in lots of different flowers, for example. It's a good example. They might stop pollinating that certain type of flower because it's not within their preference anymore. Because bigger might, for example, mean to them it signals more food.
Mm.
So they'll avoid, say, smaller flowers because maybe they also have preferences of colors.
Yeah.
But size is a good example. And size can change with temperature changes.
Yeah.
So then that will change how often the flowers pollinate or not.
That's really interesting. I never thought about that before because it kind of like a form of competition you don't really think about.
No.
Where flowers are competing for production. Like we've talked in this podcast before about like how animals will compete with each other for reproductive opportunities. Like males will like fight each other so that they can have access to a female to reproduce.
Yeah.
But yeah, the flowers are kind of like fighting each other to be the best looking flowers in terms of a bee to find them to get their pollen to the next
flower.
Yeah,
exactly.
Over.
And it's a very, because we don't see it happening. We don't see flowers, or it's such subtle changes. We don't see flowers evolve over time in the competition that happens.
Mm.
Something we don't think about.
Mm.
It's not as obvious as to, say, deer fighting with each other during the reproductive season. What do they call that? The rut
The
or
rut,
something?
Yes.
Yeah. It's not as obvious as that, but it's like climate change. And this is just temperature I'm talking about as well.
Mm.
Changes in temperature, because that's what I focused on.
Yeah.
But changes in rainfall also happens with climate change.
Mm.
Less rain, for example, some species will cause geographical shifts, or maybe plants will die out. One thing you don't realize is insects do drink water.
Yes, true.
So people don't think about it because they don't really witness it. But if there's no water for them, but maybe the plant can tolerate the low moisture in that environment, they're not going to get pollinated.
Right.
So they will have to do... they won't have what's called outcrossing. So they'll start to become inbred because plants can sometimes pollinate themselves, self-fertilize. But that's not great because then we don't have genetic diversity and they have less genetic diversity, so they're less adaptable to changes. So as time goes on, as there's more inbreeding, they're going to become more sensitive to climate change.
So theoretically, you talk about a scenario where there's a massive drought that sweeps through an area, as we've seen in New Zealand many, many times over the past decade or so. That leads to a reduction in pollinator numbers because the insects die at first, essentially. Mm. Then the plants are forced to inbreed with themselves and then therefore aren't as well set up for the next set of kind of...
Extreme events
or things that happen to them. That's really interesting.
Yeah, and if you think about it, more droughts or if there's heat, extreme heat events, heat waves, the pollinators are going to need more water because they're going to be more active. The metabolism is higher. They're going to need more water to keep up all these activities with the higher heat, to cope with heat.
Mm.
And if there's less water around because of a drought, they're going to struggle even more than they would before. Yeah. So it's really, climate change is something, it's not simple. And the thing is, even with us, it's not a simple problem, which is why it's so difficult to study, it's so difficult to fix.
Mm.
Yeah.
When you say it's difficult to study, is part of that like difficulties in comparisons, like finding a baseline? Like climate change has been running for so long that it's hard to kind of compare between one state and the other? Like you said, it's difficult to that we know that flower shape has changed, for example. But was that something that was, say, difficult for the people who did those studies to prove because they needed like a baseline reference of what the flowers used to look like? Or
yeah, I suppose it could be. Or it's like, for example, in my case, when it comes to, I did my, most of the stuff I did was in the lab.
Mm.
So because there's so many components, rainfall, temperature, all sorts of things changing, it's hard to choose what aspect to look at. It's hard to control certain aspects and be like, what is a realistic scenario? Because we don't necessarily know what's going to happen in the future.
Mm.
How do you choose what's realistic for the future?
Yeah. Presumably you want to choose like one thing to change, like say temperature or like, how would you represent rainfall in the lab? The humidity,
no.
I guess?
Yeah, or, yeah, suppose.
But that's its
so.
Own thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, but what I'm getting at is you want to change like one aspect of it so that your experiments are comparable. But that
exactly.
also is not what happens in reality. Like just from, like, again, our own experience in the last few years, we know that like temperature changes along with changes in weather patterns, right?
Yeah. So exactly. And then when you look at your results from an experiment where you only change one like component, you have to also take that results with a grain of salt and know that it will be or could be different out in the real world, which sometimes makes it, then you need more research, and you know, time is limited when it comes to climate change. You know,
so research that you were looking at in kind of the literature you were looking at coming up to doing your own experiments was looking at changes out in the world between where pollinators live and where the flowers live due to climate change, and changes in their like the timings that the different species are active and whether those match up or not. Where does your work fit in? How is that? What were you doing that people hadn't done before?
Oh, that's always a tricky question.
Yeah, I feel like I'm on your supervisor panel asking you that question. Yeah. Sorry.
And I wouldn't say like I haven't. This is brand new research, but it's new in terms of focusing on insect pollinators. So what I looked at specifically was metabolism and behavior. So because insects specifically are ectothermic and they rely on temperature for activity because it, you know, cold-blooded, heats them up, gets their metabolism going.
Yeah. Can you talk me through what you mean by ectothermic? Sorry.
Oh, so ectotherms are, in other words, cold-blooded animals. We've all heard of those. They're animals like snakes and lizards that rely on heat to warm them up so that they can be active. And what happens is as the temperature increases, their metabolism increases as well and changes. And depending on how your metabolic rate is, that determines how much energy you need to fuel that metabolism. So there's this idea called the metabolic theory of ecology, where...
This definitely sounds like something you need to break down for us.
Yes, I definitely will. So it's this theory, it's based on a couple equations with its temperature, body size, and metabolism. And using these, if you have this information, or you have two of these details about a certain species, you can predict another one, and it helps you predict ecological patterns and processes. So, for example, let's focus on insect pollinators. If you have the temperature and their body size, you can predict how their metabolism will be affected.
Mm-hmm.
You can calculate the metabolic rate, for example.
And when you're talking about metabolism, what do you mean by that?
So that's just how they process food.
Mm-hmm.
So it's often calculated from respiration rates. So it's basically the process in which your body breaks down food to make energy. The metabolic theory of ecology can kind of give you an idea of how, especially with climate change, how temperature can affect metabolism, can affect the energetic needs of insects.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So I wanted to look and see. So this metabolic theory of ecology is highly debated, as lots of theories are. They're like, is this actually something we can use broadly to make broad assumptions? And there's been a lot of studies on stuffed fish and other insects as well, but there hasn't been as broad a data set on insect pollinators. So I focused on four different generalist species. Two flies and two bees. Flies are actually really important pollinators. I need to say this. Lots of people, love bees. Bees are great. Really important.
Bees are what everybody thinks about when you talk about pollinators.
Yeah, but there are so many flies, and there are even fly species that only pollinate.
Really?
Their only job in life, and there are so many species. Like we just spoke about, the word we forgot, specialist pollinators are flies, where they only pollinate one type of flower. You get these long-tongued flies which have adapted with one species. Over time, they've competed. I'm totally off topic now, but I've...
Love
fly pollinators. So they've actually in this constant race, because what they'll do is they'll evolve their tongue so long that their face doesn't touch where the pollen is. So they almost steal, steal. They get nectar without pollinating.
This is an interesting thing about pollination. The rewards are different. What the plant wants is often different from what the insect wants,
The plant doesn't necessarily want to give too much away because that's waste of energy. It could be using that energy to make more flowers, to make more pollen instead of nectar. And some insects take the pollen as well to eat for themselves. They don't necessarily transfer all of it,
and that's like worst case scenario for the plant, because that's like your future offspring that are being eaten.
So pollination is a mutualistic, is that they do benefit but not all the time, and they're not doing it out of the good of their own heart. You can't think of it in that way. So it's like this race, and then the flower will make itself longer so that the fly smushes its face into the pollen and doesn't get any nectar. And it, like, the fly then will make its tongue longer.
So the
just to reach the nectar. So over time.
the flower is competing by making its pollen delivering like
so
structure
just
longer.
The flower itself, so it's just a very long flower. It's almost like a tube flower. Mm. Some flowers look like little tubes, so they'll just make the whole. So at the bottom, you'll have the where the nectar sits there, where it attaches to the stem. Mm. Or the petiole, I don't know what it's called. Sometimes I forget my...
Just the stem. Stem is fine.
Yeah.
So, I'm a entomologist. Yeah, I don't know flower terms. Man.
Same. I didn't study the flowers. I studied the bugs. Let's be clear. So, and then the top where the pollen sits, where the anthers. So flowers have what's called anthers, and that's what you often see in flowers. The yellow part, it sticks at the top.
Yeah, that's so pollen, the part that actually holds the pollen, and it would that would be what people are familiar with, like the kind of like the... like drops the kind of dusty part in the middle of the flower. Yeah.
So that'll be at the opening. Mm. And then the petals form together. They will, instead of having separate petals, they'll be fused. So they'll form this little tube. And the fly will have to sit at the top and stick its tongue down the tube to get the pollen.
Or to get the nectar of a pollen.
The nectar. Sorry, they don't worry about the pollen. Then by sitting on it, by putting their face into the opening, they get the pollen on their face.
Mm.
And then by doing the same thing at the next flower, they transfer the pollen because the female organ will be in a similar place.
And the fly is essentially trying to kind of cheat the flower by evolving this long tongue to kind of just steal the nectar and then leave without actually taking any pollen with it.
Yeah.
Which seems rude, honestly.
Yeah. I don't think they do it consciously.
Mm.
But it's...
It's that word that you didn't want to say.
Yeah, we can't anthropomorphize. But I think it's more just the flower doesn't think, but it doesn't want nectar to waste energy or nectar, so it gets longer, but the fly wants to keep reaching it, so it needs to evolve its tongue longer to reach it, and at some point...
Right.
Yeah.
That's really interesting.
Yeah.
Well, I want to ask you about how you feel about the metabolic theory of ecology, which I'm sure is a question no one has ever actually asked you. But what I'm wondering is, were you one of those people that got into biology because it was a way in high school to avoid doing like more maths and physics, and then you ended up working on this big equation with all these weird symbols and stuff in it?
No, I was a bit of a weirdo. I love maths. Gosh, I used to, when we got homework from high school, I used to love sitting, and that feeling when you finally got figured out. I don't know if anyone relates to this. It might just be me, but once you figure it out, it's like that satisfaction, like, oh my god, I actually got it, I figured it out, I know how to do this. I like maths, and I'll be honest, the metabolic theory of ecology is like one equation that you switch around.
Yeah,
once you've got it, it's easy.
Mm.
Which is, I guess, so you're saying, what is your opinion on it? I'm someone who doesn't like to just hate a theory immediately. Mm. I don't think it's perfect. I think the idea of having one unifying equation that can predict everything is not likely.
We apologize to any physicists who are listening, but also we don't.
Yeah, no. But biologically, like I said earlier about pollination and climate change, there are so many factors that won't be taken into consideration in one equation.
Mm. Yeah.
But I think it can... When it comes to climate change and wanting to understand stuff quickly, it can give us a an idea of what's happening. And I think it can be useful. And it's finding out where it's useful that's important.
So you think it's a kind of a piece of the larger puzzle of what you're saying is a very complex problem, this problem of predicting the impacts of climate change on all these different species.
Yeah. And I don't see the issue with having a simplistic idea of something, but that might be able to show... It sometimes, even if it is a simplistic idea, it won't show everything about it, but it will still show what maybe is important for us to focus on.
Mm. So you're talking about this metabolic theory, which has the, what were the three parts again?
So there's temperature, metabolism, and body size. So how body size scales, because interestingly, body size scales with metabolism in a predictable way.
Mm. What do you mean by that?
So as an animal gets bigger, you expect its metabolism to change according to this ratio. It's called a three-quarter. So it doesn't change one-to-one. It doesn't, as a thing gets 1 centimeter bigger, the metabolism changes by one unit.
Mm.
It changes by like three-quarters of a unit.
So the metabolism increases but at a slower rate than body size?
What people say is 75%, I guess. Mm.
So if you were looking at, say, a mouse and an elephant, and if an elephant is, say, 100 times larger than a mouse, I don't know if they are.
I don't think 100 of them are, but more, 1,000?
We don't need to worry about... They're vertebrates, they're all the same.
Okay, true.
But if it was 100 times the size, it wouldn't have 100 times the metabolic rate. It would have 75 times the metabolic rate.
Yeah, but that's the metabolic theory of ecology. Mm. That's not necessarily true for each organism. That's a very broad generalization.
Okay. Yes.
Because what you're doing is saying for all animals, for all organisms, this body mass metabolism ratio. Yeah. That's not necessarily true for plants.
Yes.
Insects, fish, birds... Maybe not. That's what's debatable about it. But there's no reason why we can't have a general ratio for insect pollinators or for bees that we use for all bee species instead of having... Because there's thousands of species out there, hundreds of thousands. So you don't want one for each of them, but maybe there are groupings we can do that will make understanding how climate change affects a group.
And is that what you were trying to look at, trying to get at with your work?
Yeah.
All right, so talk me through that a little bit.
Oh, so do you want to know the methods?
What were you trying to figure out? Just explain that to me a little more.
Okay, so I was trying to figure out, according to this equation, so temperature also scales with metabolism. So as temperature gets higher, metabolism also increases, but also not in a one-to-one ratio. It depends on the organism.
Mm-hmm.
But people say it's this 0.6, so like a 60%. As metabolism changes, it'll have like a... Instead of a 1-to-1 ratio, it's a 1-to-0.6 ratio.
But in general, the idea is that as things get warmer, organisms need more kind of food and resources to sustain themselves? Is that what's
getting at? So I wanted to see what you can potentially see is if it's different, if this ratio isn't actually the same, you might actually see for some species, temperature increases, the metabolism increases more dramatically. So you can see, are different species more sensitive to climate change? And that's what I wanted to see, compare between the species. Are all pollinators, like generalist pollinators, equally sensitive? Or is there a difference in the sensitivity? And can we use this difference in their sensitivity to temperature as a way to predict the way they're affected by climate change?
Right. So you're using the kind of this somewhat obscure mathematics of this metabolic theory to predict, or to try and predict, the impacts of real-life temperature changes on these insects.
It's not necessarily... I don't make any strong predictions, but I want to see, can we use the metabolic theory of ecology? Is it a useful tool to make predictions?
And assuming that it is, how would that be useful in the real world?
Right, so if we were able to test and understand the different species' sensitivity, or if, say, all groups of pollinators responded the same according to metabolic theory. Maybe they had the same ratio. So we know that as temperature increases, they all are, say, maybe bees are more sensitive than flies, for example. We could say, okay, bees need to be the focus of conservation. Mm-hmm. We need to, it's not necessarily true, bees, this is just vague. Mm-hmm. Don't take this as a fact.
Yeah.
But it can tell you which species are at more danger than others. Mm-hmm. Where to focus conservation efforts, how in danger is pollination to climate change, how much money and effort do we need to put into conserving this really important ecosystem service. So that's why it's important to have predictors.
And when you say figure out which species or groups are in more danger, what do you mean by danger? What's this temperature increase potentially leading to for them?
So all animals have a limit of temperature they can handle. And understanding metabolism shows kind of an idea, gives you an idea of that limit. The more sensitive a species is, the more quickly their metabolism will change with temperature. So as temperature changes, you'll have more dramatic increases in metabolism, and which means they'll get more quickly to their limit, their metabolic limit, which eventually animals will reach a limit where they can no longer take in enough energy to reach support metabolism, so they'll basically starve.
They can't eat fast enough to keep up with their own needs.
No. So if your needs increase faster with certain temperature changes, you're going to be more in trouble as temperature increases.
And that's a potential impact, a direct impact of climate change on these animals.
Yes.
That's terrifying.
It is. Yeah. But it's something that's not just a way. There's been some really interesting stuff with metabolism on lots of other different species as well, not just like there's been work on reptiles because they're also cold-blooded, and some fish as well. There's been really interesting stuff out there done to look at limits and how climate change affects them as well.
Mm. Sorry, I'm just going to have to take a moment because that's really, really scary, because we think about climate change in like the things we were talking about before, like how it changes to habitats and where organisms like to live, and like melting of ice caps and things that feel like that are terrifying in their own way, that feel abstract in a way.
Yeah,
but now here we are talking about like, so these bees are just going to be microwaved essentially on the planet.
And it's crazy to think that it's not just bees.
Mm.
You know, I mean, oceans are warming too. Fish are used to an ocean that stays very constant in temperature.
You're listening to The Science Bug, which is a real feel-good podcast that just makes you feel great about the world.
Honestly. But that's why I think, I don't know if anyone cares about this, but that's why I got into science, because you just, it's so scary, you want to do something. You know, you want to try find a way, you know, work within a community that's actually trying to make changes, trying to save these animals from climate change. But yeah, it can be really scary and like overwhelming to lots of people.
That's an absolutely brilliant sentiment.
You can hear the second half of Simon's interview with Renee next week, where they'll be talking about what Renee's results might mean for the future of these pollinating bugs, including her favourite flies. You've been listening to The Science Bug with Simon Connolly and Morgan Marion. You can find us at Science Bug Pod on Instagram and Twitter. This podcast is made possible by Free FM, and you can find our previous episodes on Apple, Spotify, or your favorite podcasting app. Catch you next time!
For more episodes, use the accessmedia.nz app for iOS and Android devices, or subscribe to this podcast via Spotify, iHeartRadio, or Apple Podcasts. This Free FM podcast was brought to you with support from New Zealand On Air.